What was the Kansas City arts experience that totally made your year in 2017? For one of KCUR's arts reporters, it wasn't about a great painting or a stellar performance in a play. It was something a musician said during his banter with the audience.
If you don't know who I am, I'm born and bred from the inner city of Kansas City, Missouri. 55th Street.
That's Logan Richardson performing at the 18th and Vine Jazz Heritage Festival. He's an internationally known saxophonist, and he stopped in the middle of his set to say a few words.
It's really a pleasure and honor to be here. When I left Kansas City, I ran away and I never came back, basically. I've been kind of chasing the legacy that's been instilled inside of me from the great masters that come from the city. And I think anytime I go somewhere else and people in other places are more familiar with the masters that come from this land and this soil and this earth and this air, more familiar than us, then we have some homework to do about the rich legacy that lives here. Amen. And it lives on.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're looking back on 2017 in the arts. KCUR's CJ Janovee is kicking things off with why she loved that speech so much, and then we'll meet the rest of our panel. Hi, CJ.
Hi, Gina.
So take us back to that Logan Richardson performance at 18th and Vine at the Jazz Heritage Festival back in May.
Yeah, so that was over Memorial Day, and it was a three-day festival, and this was the last day, and it was sort of late in the, well, it was late in the afternoon, and there were a couple hundred people on the grassy median on Paseo, and I had never seen Logan Richardson perform before, and I was super eager to hear him. Excuse me, he had just come off of a year of rave reviews for his album called Shift in 2016. NPR named this one of the 50 best albums of the year, so he was up there with Beyonce and David Bowie. This is one of the cuts off that album that is playing now. And his set astounded me. It was just so powerful. And he had this group of young musicians playing with him, and he stepped up to the microphone, and I was like, I want to hear who these musicians are. I thought he was just going to introduce his band. And he began talking, and he went on for about 5 or 6 minutes, actually. And in addition to what we heard, he talked about how the city had made an investment in him when he was young, and he wanted to see that same investment in the up-and-coming jazz artists in town. He talked about how the city had poured millions of dollars into 18th and Vine and the Jazz Museum specifically, and he wished he could see little kids in the crowd. He said he wished the organizers would have had free admission for kids, which I don't think probably had occurred to anyone. And it was just this really poignant moment from someone who had left and really made an international name for himself. And that festival turned out to be very problematic. Attendance was lower than it was sort of an overly ambitious and under-executed festival. And a month later, my colleague Laura Spencer reported that some musicians still hadn't been paid. And two months later, some of the vendors hadn't been paid still. And I just feel like Richardson's speech was this sort of impromptu state of the arts in Kansas City.
Recognizing some of why things weren't quite working as expected.
Well, certainly in jazz world, I think, and around 18th and Vine.
It's interesting to me that this sort of speech that's like a reckoning and this incredible talent from Kansas City that he's standing there acknowledging, like, I ran away from this place, that was a great moment for you.
Well, he also talked about how whether you know me or not, you need to know the names that influenced me. He referenced, you know, sort of a litany of Kansas City jazz greats, Ahmad Aladin, Sonny Kenner, people who had taught him, and he said, whether you guys know me or not, I'm an international ambassador for this music and this place.
Well, you know, we did mention that he is, you know, internationally known, but he's not one of the people we constantly pat ourselves on the back for sending out into the world.
I don't think, you know, I think he ought to be a household name in Kansas City. I know that the kind of jazz that he plays is super challenging and not necessarily easy to listen to. But it felt to me that day as if I was hearing the all of the intense layers of challenge and beauty in the whole world being reflected in the, you know, by this group of musicians from Kansas City, and some of them very young. The youngest one was 18.
Yeah, the people in his band were Kansas City musicians.
Correct.
So we mentioned also that the festival itself turned out to be on some level kind of a fiasco. And this seems like maybe a good time to bring in one of our other guests for this artsy year in review. Glenn North is a poet. He's the director of the Black Archives, but he spent many years working for the American Jazz Museum. And I'm guessing he has some insight and just personal feelings about this inaugural 18th and Vine Jazz Heritage Festival. Glenn, hello.
Hello.
So to put you totally on the spot.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it's really a mixed bag, Gina. I totally understand where CJ's coming from. And, you know, over the years, I can't say Logan and I are close friends, but I definitely have a rapport with him. And we've had some pretty in-depth conversations. And I know that he loves Kansas City. But he does struggle with the fact that, you know, the era that he came up in, you know, the programming that was available to him and the mentorship that was available to him, all of that hasn't been maintained in the way that it was when he was in high school and he had all of these resources through the Jazz Museum and the Jazz District. So, speaking to what happened with the festival, you know, I think it was a grand attempt, and I hate that it wasn't successful. I do have some understanding of why it wasn't, but I always, like Logan, feel that I'm an ambassador for the district, and as much as I struggle with how things have unfolded over the past year and a half or so, I also want to make sure that Kansas City understands that some great things are continuing to happen in the midst of all of it. So as I was thinking about the year in review, one of the highlights for me was the Brass and Bougie mashup with Marcus Lewis, who's a trombone player, and he also is the leader of a big band. And he worked with two local hip hop artists, Kemet Coleman, and who's also known as the Phantom. Let me not forget that. And also Kadesh
Phantom
Flo.
With the PH.
Yeah, exactly. And so the initial performance that they did at Ruins Pub, I wasn't able to make it that night. But just this past weekend, they did another performance at the Blue Room. And it was one of the best shows I've seen. It's the most fun I've had all year. There were people from all walks of life, all ages. The style of hip-hop that Kemet and Kadesh are performing is very progressive and thought-provoking. Marcus Lewis's arrangements are phenomenal. And it was one of those moments where everybody in the room, you know, and you might have had moments like that when you were watching Logan Richardson, when everybody at the festival, you just felt that connection.
Yeah, you
like
feel there's electricity moment. Sometimes
yeah.
In a moment.
And that's not an infrequent thing. I mean, but you don't hear that talked about a lot in the media. So I really think one of the challenges of the district is we need some good PR people to help balance a lot of the negativity that gets out there. And we deserve, you know, criticism is important. It's important to deal with the issues that we're confronted with. So I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. But at the same time,
the actual art, it seems to be. Like
yeah, absolutely. There's just a certain narrative that I think we need to there needs to be a counter narrative, you know, to help people understand some of the good things that are going on.
So back into this
in the district.
Brass and Bougie situation
right.
You're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You said it's thought provoking.
Yeah.
Can you get into a little more detail on that for me? You know, like what happened that was thought provoking when you were listening in at the Blue Room?
Well, the way that Marcus can take a song that was written by Kadesh or Kemet and take what would normally be, you know, I'm not a musician, but, you know, a hip-hop beat, for lack of a better way to put it, and create a big band arrangement that doesn't sound contrived, to bring in the lyricism and the topics that Kadesh and Kemet are addressing, dealing with issues of racism, dealing with... But not only that, some of them are just kind of like party jams, too. You know what I mean? And so when you think of a big band, you know, even me having worked at the Jazz Museum for several years, you know, I think of Duke Ellington, I think of Count Basie, and I kind of think of a more kind of a old school, this is what my grandparents listened to. And when you can create this kind of fresh sound that's not like anything that's being done in music right now.
Hip-hop and big band aren't... Yeah. The most obvious combination.
Right. And so, yeah, the way that they are able to mash that up in a way that works. And everybody in the audience is looking at each other like, are you hearing what I'm hearing? Are you feeling like I'm feeling? That's exciting. Yeah.
Do you know when there's another opportunity to catch them?
I don't, but I do know that they plan on continuing the project, for lack of a better way to put it. I know that it's ongoing. And so I guess, you know, just kind of keep your ear to the ground with Marcus probably, but definitely, you know, Kemet and Kadesh, to kind of find out when there will be subsequent performances. But I know, especially with the response that they got last Saturday, that they'll be doing it again.
Okay, well, let's meet. We've got two of our panelists introduced here. We've talked to CJ Janovy, KCUR's arts reporter, and Glenn North. He's the director of the Black Archives. Let's meet our other two panelists. Libby Hansen is here. She writes a culture blog called Proust Eats a Sandwich, and she also writes music reviews at KCUR.org. Hi, Libby.
Hi.
And Jose Faust is here as well. He's an artist in many genres and a founding member of the Latino Writers Collective. Welcome, Jose.
Welcome, Gina.
So I want to get each of you an opportunity to tell us about one of your favorite arts moments in 2017, and pretty soon we'll invite our listeners to join this conversation. Jose, kick this off. Tell me about the visual art show that took you by surprise at the Kemper this year.
Well, that was just... To finish one thing, though, that Glenn was talking about, in terms of the recognition, UNESCO designating Kansas City as a music city,
yes.
Specifically because of what happens at 18th and Vine at the Musicians Foundation.
Thank you.
That was a big moment for you?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a beautiful
big moment for the city.
Yeah, let's start there and let everyone at the panel weigh in. I mean, first of all, tell me about, for you, like, what that means to you.
I'll give you a great example. A friend of mine called me up 2 years ago doing couch surfing. Had some people that came in from... out of the country, from Spain particularly, and they were looking for a place to stay. They stayed at her place. She called me up and said, hey, they want to go do something. It was a First Friday. So we went out and we did a First Friday, and then we ended up at Majestic. And I think, I'm trying to remember if Mark Lowry was playing. But they were so enthralled. And what they were doing was they were following Route 66 across the country. And they were heading from here to Dodge City. So it was a beautiful night. We got home and everything. About a month later, she gets an email from one of the people and said there were two things that they remembered the most about their month and a half long trip across the states. One was being at the Majestic. The other one was being at Dodge City for a rodeo. And I thought how beautiful that is in a way. But I think that idea that they could appreciate and know. I mean, they wanted to go specifically hear Kansas City jazz. And how refreshing is that when you live in a city where most people don't want to go hear anybody that plays jazz? And it's sad. So I think it's kind of a double-edged sword. You get this recognition, but I think a lot of people don't understand why it's such an important recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, we're the only city that has that designation. And so what that means is that we're going to be in a position now to attract a lot of attention from the music world in ways that we wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And one of the things that UNESCO looked at when they made that distinction is just like Jose said, was the 18th and Vine jazz area, the tradition, but not only the tradition, what's still happening in places like the Mutual Musicians Foundation and the Blue Room. So, yeah, I think that we've yet to realize what an impact that's going to have on the music scene here in Kansas City.
Libby, anything to add to that?
I think they pretty much covered the significance.
Well, yeah, for you, I mean, you've recommended a lot of different music events here in town that mm-hmm. you're remembering fondly. Is there something that's jumping out to you as you hear this conversation that's going on?
Well, yeah, like the UNESCO thing is a huge deal, and yes, I think it'll generate some internal interest with the art scene. But it was interesting when you had us sort of like talk about what's your number one top thing, and I couldn't pick a number one top thing.
Yeah, you picked I think like five or six.
But what I didn't realize until I put the list together is that I was sort of drawn to very intimate, personal, a lot of solo performances. And I think a few of those came from like out of town guests, but most of them were from local Kansas City artists, and just the level of individual musicianship and artistry that's happening is really, I mean, just one person on a stage has been my favorite moments, and it's incredible to think that just extrapolates, and then people collaborate and they do new projects and everything. And it's just the, you know, you're sharing something with 200 of your best friends, is kind of amazing. And to share something so personal as a soloist, and to make that connection, the connection that Glenn was talking about, is just it was kind of amazing to me, because I tend to like the brassy, loud, you know, really boisterous performances. And then when I really reflected, it was all the very intimate solo stuff.
Tell me about the Calvin Arsenia performance that blew your mind.
That he is probably one of the, he's possibly one of the best artists happening in Kansas City right now. It's just everything I've seen him do, and I haven't seen him a bunch, maybe two or three times, has been sincere and intimate in a way that is impossible to front.
Like, for those who don't know, I'm sorry. What does he play?
Oh, he plays the harp.
Right.
Like, and I think he's a multi-instrumentalist, but sort of his and I'm not that familiar with harp literature. He plays a small harp. Well, no, he plays like multiple different types of harps, right? Yeah, so that's interesting, and you would think
it's very
that,
atmospheric.
Like, it's atmospheric, but the delivery of the line is very personal. I liken him to another Kansas City runaway, which is Crystal Warren, who has just a personal, such an amazing personal. Even when she's covering somebody else's song, she really makes it her own, and it's just she's one of my favorite musicians. And so I feel like he's on this tier. And the KKFI Collaborations Live, which is what I put on there, that was a really great night of collaboration. Another one was, now I can't remember his name, Something Black. And he was supposed to perform with Kelly Hunt, and she was sick. And so he did a set just by himself. At that event, and that I was tears just the whole time. It was just such a beautiful, intimate moment with 500 of your closest friends, and it was an amazing event. That was definitely a top 10.
That's Libby Hansen remembering a KKFI collaboration,
Collaborations Live. Yeah, that was the event.
And we are going to get right back to this year in the arts. What did you see that you loved? Did you have a life-changing experience? We're talking music, writing, visual art, theater, whatever your thing happens to be. 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard on KCUR is a look back on the arts in 2017 with Glenn North. He's the director of the Black Archives here in Kansas City, artist and writer Jose Faust, cultural critic Libby Hansen, and KCUR's arts reporter CJ Janovy. Hi again, everyone.
Hello.
You can join this conversation at 816-235-2888. We're looking for the moment in your year of local art stuff that really stands out, something you'll remember for years to come. 816-235-2888. And CJ, you're drawing our attention to a poetry interview with a local figure we sadly lost this year.
Yes, this was a New Letters on the Air interview between Angela Elam and Michelle Boisseau, who was on the faculty at UMKC and died just a few weeks ago. And I listened to that radio show, and I'm sort of eager to hear Jose talk about it because he was actually there live at the Kansas City Public Library. But it was about Michel Boisseau's most recent book of poetry, Among the Gorgons, and it was, you know, she was extremely animated and funny and sort of raucous, and these poems.
And that was her personality.
That was totally her personality. And the poems are about aging and aging women, and they're about mortality, and it was just very poignant to listen to around the time of her death. But mm-hmm. I'd love to hear.
No, I loved it. You know, Michelle has always been kind of there as somebody that you know of. I know Glenn took classes from her. And it's always been kind of, she took the sabbatical, and when she came back from that sabbatical, there was just this openness that I sensed. And so when we were there that day, it was so funny. I mean, it was like, I had no clue she was sick or anything. It just seemed like she was celebrating something. And Angela and her just had this really nice banter. There was a lot of self-deprecating humor. There was sassiness. There was kind of like taking a stand about issues. But it was so warm. I mean, I still remember that evening so well because I remember leaving and going, wow, you know.
Tell me, I mean, for our listeners who may not be familiar with her or her work, what do you think are the crucial things to know about why people in town are just so crazy about her, those who did know her, those who do know her work?
Well, I mean, personally, I can just say to me, it's genuine. It's genuine work. I mean, there's a craft that sometimes you don't even notice when you read it, and I think that's the best kind of work, any kind, where you really don't notice that there's like this thing happening. You just are taken in by the work. And in the book, in the Gorgons, like you're talking about, she's talking about mortality, but it's not a put-off thing. It's almost like a welcoming understanding and acceptance. And it's not maudlin in any way. It just seems like the musings of somebody that you could really sit by and just listen to all day. It was just very beautiful.
On a very personal note, like, Michelle and I had a really complicated relationship. I started off in the MFA program back in 2006. It was newly emerging. And she was...
At UMKC.
I'm sorry. Yes, at UMKC. And she was just very, very passionate about the craft, as Jose said. And to be honest with you, I was not a great student. And, you know, she saw potential in me, and she didn't feel like I was living up to it. And we had some really heated moments, but I always knew that it was because she cared and wanted to see me do better. We had conversations about her previous book, A Sunday in Guide Years, when she came to the realization that her ancestors had owned slaves and how she struggled with that. And so we talked a lot about race and how complicated that is. And I never finished the MFA program. That's still a thorn in my side. That's something that I want to complete. It's just, you know, life keeps getting in the way. But having said that, the last time I saw her was at an artist talk at the Kemper. And I walked up to her, and I always kind of had this uneasiness because I never finished, and I always wanted, you know, to have that under my belt. So whenever I saw her, that guilt would kind of, you know, stir up in me. And I went over to her, and I said, I know we've got some unfinished business. And she just hugged me, and she said, no, we don't. She said, you're doing the work. She said, degrees are important, but, in you know, they're really just pieces of paper, you know. And that was so comforting to me. And that was our last interaction. And I'm glad that I was able to have that moment with her.
I didn't know her well, but she always really struck me as an incredibly warm and unpretentious person. Yeah. For someone as accomplished as she was in an academic setting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You did not have to wonder where she was coming from. Yeah, she had no problem with speaking her mind at all. And I think that, you know, most of us that studied with her, like I said, and I say this very lovingly, but she was a difficult person. I mean, because if you're writing a poem and you're putting your heart out there and, you know, you get the kind of feedback that she would sometimes give, you know, that can sometimes affect, you know, how you interact with that person. But ultimately, I think anybody who, you know, studied with her has been better for it.
All right. Well, we've been talking about Michelle Boisseau. Any additional words, CJ?
Well, just one. Excuse me. One thing that, I mean, you can listen to this interview anytime. It's New Letters on the Air. Search for Michelle Boisseau, and it's about half an hour, and it will. That warmth and that feeling that Jose describes, it will sort of make you feel better about the world listening to these two folks, listening to Michelle Boisseau talk about some of the really most difficult things in life.
Including death.
Exactly.
With humor.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn, you've got some national poetry news you want to talk about. Tracy K. Smith being appointed Poet Laureate of the United States and Tayemba Jess being awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Local only in that you're hoping to bring them both to Kansas City in 2018.
Yay. Yes. and I'll just be, you know, very candid, you know, with all the things that are happening in the world, you know, the climate that we're living in terms of, you know, race relations, politics, all of these different things that we're struggling with right now. I really think art has a way of being at the vanguard of the struggle and dealing with issues in a way that sometimes helps us to see things differently. But I was just very excited that two of the highest accomplishments that you can achieve in the world of poetry are these two people are people that I actually know. And I don't want to, you know, make it sound like we hang out and, you know, we're BFFs. But I was able to take a workshop with Tracy K. Smith in St. Louis over the course of 2 weeks. And just she had a profound impact on my writing. And then she came back as part of the Midwest Poets series a couple of years ago and had a chance to kind of reconnect with her.
If you were to just say one thing about what really stands out about her work, mm-hmm. what would it be?
I would have to go back to craft again. While she's an African-American poet, she's expansive in the things that she talks about. Like the book that she won the Pulitzer Prize for was based on sci-fi space travel, the death of her father, the birth of her first child. And to be able to bring all those things together in a coherent piece of work, I think is amazing.
Especially the sci-fi space travel. Let's be honest.
She's a big David Bowie fan too. So there were some things, you know, references to some of his work in there. But yeah, so she's just a very adept in terms of the craft of poetry. And then Tayemba, who I met through Kavi Kanem, which is an African-American poetry organization, is writing these books that are inspired by African-American history and overlooked aspects of African-American history.
Such as?
So Olio, the book that he just won the Pulitzer Prize for this year, talks about black performers who didn't get recognition during the period right after, up until World War I. So like a lot of people like the Fisk Jubilee singers and Burt Williams, Paul Laurence Dunbar, Blind Boone, puts together this book in a way that's like this huge tour de force. It's like a performance. He's
and
got
Blind Boone is from Missouri,
Yeah, exactly. One of the, and then the artist, from what I understand, is also from Missouri. And just, you know, really quickly, I think that it's important in terms of my desire to bring him is the research that he had to do, working at the archives. And just quick correction, I'm the director of education and public programs at the archives, not the overall director.
That is a big difference.
So I don't want anybody mad at me. but having said that, you know, us being in archives, I would love to have him come and talk about the incredible amount of research he had to put into the work that he did.
Well, so we should keep our fingers crossed that your
absolutely
efforts
are... I'm trying to keep my cards close to my vest in terms of how all of this will unfold, but there's a very strong possibility that we will be able to see both of those poets in Kansas City next year.
Well, we're going to get right back to our panel, but I want to talk to Judy in Ottawa about a lyric opera performance that she loved this year. Hi, Judy.
Well, hi there. My experience was different than the ones that your panelists are talking about, but it was the lyric opera performance of Everest, which is an operatic recreation of the tragedy that happened on Mount Everest in the late 90s, when the expedition, most of them died. One survived, and he actually came to Kansas City to talk about his experience before the first performance. And it's just astounding how they recreated the icy mountain and how these performers, in the angst of their situation, were able to sing beautifully and to remind us all of this historic tragedy. So I would say it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Judy, thanks so much for sharing that. And Libby, you also wanted to talk about that today.
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary opera in that it's really a great introductory opera, even though it's a new opera, because it's relatively short, which was actually one of my criticisms. I was like, that could have easily been longer. And usually that is not what I think when I watch opera. But that
is a great way to leave something, is that I could have done more.
Yeah. And I'm always thinking about how things could be better. But it was a great opera. And I think every person that I spoke with really enjoyed it, which is not necessarily always the reaction. The set was amazing. I mean, really inventive. Like, how do you create a mountain on a stage and climbing and all that stuff? And they had, it was white boxes sort of attached together that were the entire height of the stage. And then they did projection mapping. So you would have, the icy mountain scape and wind and clouds, and it was just it gave elevation. I mean, you felt very, and I was actually sort of high up in the theater, sitting high up, and so I was sort of looking down on the stage, and it didn't feel like I was looking. They really managed, as in scenic design, to do that. And the performances were strong. The music was good and interesting, and had a lot of effects that weren't too jarring. I think you felt them rather than heard them. It was short, but I think originally it was on a double bill, so it was two chamber operas, and the lyric just did the one opera. So I just felt like, oh, I could have experienced more of that. But yes, it was definitely a coup for the lyric to put that on.
Let's talk to Paula in Merriam, Kansas. Paula's called 816-235-2888. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about A Perfect Night at Shakespeare in the Park this summer. It was just one of those, gentle Midwestern evenings where it cooled off and you were comfortable sitting outside. It was a performance of Macbeth with, beautiful costumes, with rich colors. And even though you've seen Macbeth, maybe 50 times, you always hear something new in Shakespeare. And I think it was Bram Winions from The Majestic who was playing piano at the top of the set. And, we were there with friends and my daughter, and it's a family tradition that we've been going, there for since she was small.
And, Paula, I don't mean to squabble with your memory, and I'm sure you remember your night perfectly, although I think Hamlet was this year.
Hamlet, that's right. Yeah. It was Hamlet, sorry. And my memory needs squabbling.
But I'm sure the rest of the night is exactly as you described.
Oh, I'm sure it is. there with friends, we had chilled white wine and fruit and goat chicken go, which is also a tradition. And it was just a complete sensual experience, visual and audio.
I'm glad you had such a wonderful night at Shakespeare in the Park. Thank you, Paula.
Okay, bye.
Paula's talking about, brings us back to the summer, and there are a lot of sort of like outdoor arts festivals and performances in the summer. Did anyone have an, Libby, you're telling us about Summer Fest, which perhaps was not outdoors, but
No, it's a chamber music every weekend in July. But I I agree. Like, summer is like my favorite time to do music or to see music. A lot of things are a little like chill. They're more chill. There's outdoor stuff. More things are open to children attending, which is important to me. Oftentimes children are free, which is important to me. But it's like consuming the arts in the summer is definitely one of my favorites. It's like, it's still light outside, so you don't feel like maybe I don't want to go out because I just want to stay home because it's dark. And yeah, the Summerfest, the one that I mentioned personally was the performance of Ravel's Piano Trio, which is just a masterwork anyway. And what was interesting to me about that particular performance is the musicians, who are all incredible, you know, local musicians, it's this beautiful piece of music, and it's really challenging. And there were moments where they messed up. But despite it not being a, like, crystal clear, perfect performance...
From a technical standpoint,
It was still... I mean, these are quibbly sort of things, right? But they're really good musicians, so you can quibble. But it was such a wonderful piece of music, and it was presented, again, so intimately that... It's still one of my favorite things that happened last year. And I think that's the amazing thing about live performance and going to things that you maybe don't recognize or expect.
And what makes a great performance, that it's not necessarily perfection.
Yes, perfection is only happens in a studio. And you can't possibly have a consistently perfect performance. But live is just so much more engaging. And you have to expect unperfect things.
I totally understand that. We have just a little time left to hear about the killer moments in Kansas City's art scene in 2017. What did you love? What's the show or performance or audience response you won't forget? Now's the time to call, because we just have a little time left. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard. This is an artsy year in review for 2017 with KCUR CJ Janovee, Glenn North, Director of Education at the Black Archives, poet and painter Jose Faust, and cultural critic Libby Hansen. You can also read her reviews at kcur.org. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Hello.
So let's go to the museum. CJ, you wanted to tell us about a Ferrelli Baez installation.
Yes, this is a giant wall-sized portrait at the Kemper Museum. That's in the atrium there. You can just walk in and see it. It's like this sort of powerful, beautiful portrait of a woman, an African American woman, and then the rest of the wall. She's huge, and the rest of the wall is this sort of patterned, textured, bluish. Wallpapery feeling, but when you get up close, it's almost feels like it's peeling paint or something. And she spoke with one of our reporters, Vicky Diaz Camacho, earlier in the year, and talked about Kansas. You know, thinking about what to paint for this commission in the Kemper, and thinking about Kansas City, as many people describe it, as this cultural crossroads. And she made this connection really from West Africa up through the Caribbean, up the rivers, and really talked about the color blue that's on the wall in the Kemper, and the connections between sort of West African indigo and sort of true blue USA blue. And you can sort of see all of those worldly influences in the colors on the wall at the Kemper. And it's
very
just really
cool.
Striking to me.
Yeah, and staying at the Kemper for a moment, Glenn and Jose, you both draw our attention to the Magnetic Field show that was there, abstract art by women of color.
Absolutely. Really, Jose, being an artist, want him to take the lead. The reason it was a moment for me is because it was a learning experience. You know, it was the first time there had been an exhibit in America for abstract art that was done by exclusively done by women of color. I didn't know any of these women. I've never been a huge fan of abstract art. And a friend of mine, Harold Smith, insisted that I go. He felt it was important for me. And I'm so glad that he did that because, you know, I think it was for that reason, the fact that, you know, in this moment that the art world is being more inclusive. And shout out to Aaron Jezitz. And it was co-curated by
Melissa Medina.
Yeah, thank you, Jose, to them for bringing that to Kansas City.
Jose, what did you love about this show?
Well, I think a lot of it is what Glenn was talking about. I feel ashamed. I went there. It was by accident. I wasn't even planning. I just ended up, the Kempers Open went in. And the show was there, and I think it's the best thing about art, I think, is when you are brought up short in terms of what you think you know. I didn't know almost all of the women in this show, never had heard of them. And I think, but absolutely, I had heard of one of them, and I got her name down here, but oh God, where did she go? She did the Malcolm X piece, which was awesome. It's just, it reminded me of The Burghers of Calais, but Rodin. It's just this one simple piece. It's on a wall. It's large. It's bronze with fabric on the bottom. A very beautiful piece. And the reason that she was the only one I knew is I didn't even know her for her art. I knew that she wrote a book about Sally Hemings. She wrote a treatment of a novel that ended up becoming, Barbara Chase Ribot. But she wrote this novel, which ended up becoming part of a lawsuit against Steven Spielberg because it dealt with Amistad. So I knew those two elements, but I didn't know anything about her art. And so I think for me, that was really revelatory. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with a Mexican-American artist here in Kansas City who is expected to, for her own community, create art that reflects what the community thinks they know about Mexican-Americans. But she's an abstract artist, a contemporary artist, and deals with this idea of how do I get my own community to accept me at the same time that I'm trying to get the general community to accept me as an artist of color doing abstract art, which somehow seems to be the purview of only white males. And I think that really kind of was revelatory. And I think if anybody didn't get a chance to see the show, please look up the people because the work is incredible. It's really beautiful.
Well, we just have a little time left, and we have a few callers, and I want to hear a little bit about what our listeners were blown away by this year. Let's talk to Debbie in Fairway. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. The event I'd like to bring to the attention of the audience was a Louder Than a Bomb. I think it was the finals, Glenn, but it was at the Kansas City Artist Coalition down near the River Market.
Yes.
And the gallery space was full of young people, the poets, their supporters, and the walls had the art of Ada Koch on the wall.
Yes.
Related to the Mothers in Charge series she had done.
Right.
So, Glenn, would you tell them more about that?
Well, hey, Lisa. Real quickly, Louder Than a Bomb is a youth poetry festival that was started 5 years ago along with Paul Richardson. We had support from the Jazz Museum through Jess Rizak. And so we do bouts in different locations. We had it at, down in the West Bottoms. Jose, help me out. Why am I blanking? River Market.
River Market, the Artist Coalition.
Yeah, KC Artist Coalition. So we use that space. And Ada Koch is an artist that I've worked with. She's worked very closely with an organization here called Mothers in Charge that deal with victims of homicide, helping their families, being a liaison for the police force to try to help solve those homicides. So long story short, all those organizations came together to support this poetry reading, and it was awesome.
Yeah, and when she talks about being struck by all the young people in the room,
right.
Can you just give us a sense of the vibe before we'll hear quickly then from one of our other listeners?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. You've got these young poets who are doing spoken word, who are talking about all of the issues that, you know, we're confronting, you know, politically, racially, socially. And you've got busloads of kids who are coming to support them like they're going to a football game or something. So the energy is incredible.
Let's talk to Robert in South Kansas City. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me.
What do you want to share?
I was blown away by Underground at the Kauffman Center this year.
What was that?
Underground is it's a dance theater about the Underground Railroad, and if you've never seen dance theater, it sounds really boring, but this was just riveting, and I took my kids, and they were glued the whole time.
Have any of our other panelists seen that?
No, but dance theater is not boring. It reminded me of one thing that I saw.
I've heard things about it. I've not seen it, but I've heard it's awesome.
It reminded me of the other performance I really liked, We Are the Landscape, Amado Espinosa and his collective. And I think it was at the Arts Asylum. I can't remember, though, because it looks so different. But I thought it was a really beautiful hour of just incredible music, incredible dancing, and imagery that you just kind of still soak up. I think about the costuming and the poetry, the music itself. That was a very beautiful thing.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, the company that puts that on, I've seen the company, I've never seen this production, is Storling Dance Theater, who... They do a lot of political or religious themed things, or spiritual, maybe is the better word. But they do a lot of interesting work. And that, I think, is it's a 10-year-old work. So it's a masterwork of the choreographer who's in, you know, it's a perennial favorite for a lot of people, I think.
Let's talk quickly with Gene in DeSoto. Hi, Gene.
Hey, good morning. A shout out to all your panelists, and good to hear what's happening in Kansas City. I love the outdoor activities put on by Guadalupe Center and also the Hispanic Heritage Festival Committee, where they do a summer, well, end of the summer, September festival at Barney Ellis Plaza and also at the Guadalupe Center. And I heard some outstanding groups. Of course, an up-and-coming group, Making Movies, are outstanding. They're getting national play. And they also played at the outdoor concerts at the Kansas City Museum. So there's a lot of things happening out there that I think will bring various communities together, not just people, you know, again, segregating into their own communities. And I think it's open. And I mean, they are open to all comers. So many of these festivals are bringing our Kansas City constituents together. So that's lovely.
Thanks, Gene. You know, that's an interesting place to sort of, you know, we're coming to a close this hour. And I've heard that a few times, that the moments that really stood out to you were moments where the people in the audience were having this sort of experience that brought them together. And Glenn, you mentioned that one of your favorite moments brought people from all walks of life, for example. And that louder than a bomb thing that our listener loved, you know, right. That it was the young people who all came and supported each other.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, I mean, is the arts kind of moving in that direction to bring people together? Because the history that I have with it is often that the arts scene is a plural thing and that people like in everything else, stamper to their corners.
At its best, that's what it does. I had no idea how political the art world was until I started working at the American Jazz Museum. And I'm woke now. I get it. But at the same time, I do see how art can create a place where you can come together and forget about all those things that separate us. And I think that we need that now more than ever.
And I think you should have a attend those things where the artists talk about their art. For me, two key moments were the Artist Inc. presentations and then the Charlotte Street Fellows who presented at the Nerman, just to see what artists are thinking when they start to create.
And that's been some of the most profound stuff you've experienced this
year? Oh, yeah, definitely. That's some artists that I had no clue where they were coming from. And then you see them and you go, oh, it just colors it in a different way that's more open.
Yeah, I would say that's my favorite part of my job, is talking to people about their work and just hearing what inspires them. And you always learn something new. Like, I learned all sorts of new things to investigate more. So it's just learning and talking. And artists love to talk about their work. So anyone can go talk to them, and it'll be great.
What these guys said.
Our time is up. Thank you so much to all of you. Arts reporter CJ Janovi, Glenn North, local poet, director of education at the Black Archives, Jose Faust, founding member of the Latino Writers Collective, and critic Libby Hansen. Thank you all.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. And tomorrow we have a two-part food show. We'll start with the Kansas City meals worth coming home for. That's for those folks who have moved away but still crave one of our delicious delicacies. and then pizza. Tomorrow at 10, KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman.